Clear from the action, the speakers who spoke in Parliament yesterday, the number of people who contacted their members of Parliament, that the overwhelming majority of members of Parliament also oppose that this government, the state visit of Donald Trump. We've heard unprecedented that the Speaker of the House, one of the most powerful positions in the House of Commons, has himself said he thinks it's absolutely inappropriate that if Donald Trump comes on a state visit, that he should be allowed the honour of speaking in Parliament to our Parliament, both the House of Commons and House of Lords. This is an incredible rejection of Donald Trump and his agenda, and we heard it last night and we heard it from right across the political spectrum, and it's really now up to the government to listen to those voices, because we have been here in the past where, of course, we have had a Prime Minister who has been willing to accept an American agenda, and that led us into a really disastrous war. 2 million people marched on the street. And of course, that Prime Minister's reputation is in tatters now. And I think there's a stark warning to Theresa May that cozying up to Donald Trump could end up with her and her reputation being in similar tatters.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us, Assad Raymond, spokesperson for Friends of the Earth International. That does it for our show. Belated happy birthday to Neil Shabata. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Shireen Ndura, and Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Mukasa Rick Speaks, Why White People Were Asked to Leave the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1966. On Tuesday, February 21st at 5:30 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Center Room 338 in Portland, Mukasa was an organizer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He continues today to advance the concept of Pan-Africanism, which is the evolution of the Black Power movement of the 1960s. Again, that's Mukasa Rick Speaks, Why White People Were Asked to Leave the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1966. On February 21st at 5:30 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Center Room 338 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, because of the membership drive, the Program Advisory Committee will meet Tuesday, February 21st at 6 p.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5:02 p.m., and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Department of Homeland Security attempts to broaden immigration enforcement. And the Oregon ACLU lashes out against the Portland Police Bureau for its increasingly cavalier brutality against peaceful protesters. We spoke to the Seattle chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World to get their take on hate speech and the increasing suppression of collective bargaining rights. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. I'm Tony.
And I'm Miriam. The Oregon branch of the American Civil Liberties Union has blasted the Portland Police Bureau for its shameful response to yesterday's Not My President's Day protest in downtown Portland. The protest, which was organized by Don't Shoot Portland, started peacefully but became more confrontational when protesters attempted to block the street. Police in riot gear ordered protesters to return to the sidewalk and began making arrests when the protesters refused to do so. During the confrontation, the police used pepper spray on individuals, and at least one protester was struck by non-lethal bullets that were fired at close range. 13 people were arrested, including several minors and a 66-year-old woman whose nose appeared to have been bloodied during the confrontation. The ACLU responded to yesterday's hyper-aggressive behavior by saying, "Today, Portland police policy led to violence against peaceful protesters, including young kids and retired public employees. The indiscriminate violence against Portlanders was shameful."
A 32-year-old man who is believed to have been homeless died Monday evening after a Southeast Portland business owner shot him, the Oregonian reported. The incident took place Monday afternoon at 82nd Avenue and Ramona Street, according to police report. The man had reportedly stored some personal belongings on the porch of Golden Key Insurance, but the business owner removed the items. The man owning the property returned Monday afternoon and entered the business in search of his belongings, a police spokesperson said. The man reportedly threatened the owner and his wife, the spokesperson said. There was a confrontation and the business owner fired a shot. Upon conclusion of the police investigation, the case will be referred to a grand jury.
Two police officers fatally shot a man on the roof of a Beaverton house at Southwest 170th Avenue on Tuesday morning, a police spokesman said. The man was armed with a gun. He had climbed onto the steep roof and was aiming his weapon at people inside the home and on the street. Beaverton police closed streets near Southwest 170th Avenue and Merlot Road and placed two schools in the neighborhood on lockout for an hour. Buses to the schools were diverted. Police told reporters at the scene that no update will be released until the Washington County District Attorney's Office gives approval. The investigation is ongoing.
Everyone agrees that the city of Portland and Multnomah County are in the midst of a housing and homeless emergency. But few people agree on how many homeless people there are, or whether the situation is getting better or worse. This week's point-in-time count may provide some answers. The count is mandated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and is intended to provide government officials with the information they need to allocate funding and apply available resources. The HUD-mandated count is scheduled to begin tomorrow, February 22nd, and is intended to count every individual who sleeps outside on that night. The counting effort will continue through February 28th to ensure that everyone who slept outside on the 22nd gets counted. In addition, there will be a one-night count of people in shelters. The most recent count was made in January of 2015, when a total of 3,800 individuals were either on the street, in shelters, or temporary housing. Slightly over half were on the street. The stated goal in 2015 was to cut the homeless rate in half by 2017, but with the ongoing housing shortage and related rent hikes, that goal is unlikely to have been met.
The first ever Cannabis Wedding Expo in Denver last year attracted 300 attendees and 35 companies offering everything from hemp gowns and pot-themed bouquets to marijuana-infused catering and bud-tending services. This year, the event is expanding to locations in Portland and San Francisco. On March 26, the expo opens at the Left Bank Annex here. The expo promises to help couples discover custom hemp wedding dresses, cannabis floral arrangements, cannabis-friendly venues, caterers, photographers, transportation companies, and more. The event also aims to address some of the stressful aspects of getting married. There will be glass blowing, hair and makeup demonstrations, and a speed dating lounge in case you lack a partner. As a pot-free alternative, the Portland Bridal Show begins February 25th at the Convention Center.
The Standing Rock Water Protectors are facing February 22nd orders to evacuate issued by the Army Corps of Engineers, the Governor of North Dakota, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. San Franciscan and Buddhist practitioner Hanson Lee just returned from his third trip to Standing Rock and said that volunteers are urgently needed now. KPFA Berkeley News reporter Ann Garrison spoke to Hanson Lee.
Hanson Lee, you just returned from your third trip to Standing Rock. Could you tell us what you saw this time and how it differed from your first two trips?
Yeah, this time, because of the weather change and because of the artificial deadline has to be moved out of a potentially flooded zone, it disturbed everyone there. Most of all, there's not enough volunteer to move huge amount of teepees, yurts, tents, and all the fireworks and all the food and clothing. They all need to be properly moved either to higher ground or different reservation sites. But nevertheless, everyone is working very hard. Many folks are quite fatigued by day in and day out moving things and working, relocate a temporary building.
Yeah, I spoke to someone last week who had just arrived from Maine, and she said that the first thing she saw was a lot of people working their butts off. Does that sound, accurate?
Yes, sometimes there's a moving vehicle arrive literally 10 p.m. and they call up on the action, so everyone jump in to move 2 to 5 tons of food out of the location to the different reservation, because those folks are driving almost 10 hours to arrive, so all this material can be relocated to the proper place.
They're driving 10 hours with a moving vehicle so that they can go down and load it up at Oseti Sakawan and move it to higher ground. Is that right?
Correct. Okay. Either to higher ground or to different reservations so they can be safely stored.
Hanson Lee also said that he believes the Army Corps controls floodgates to protect the city of Bismarck that would allow them to flood the Oseti Sakawan camp unnecessarily before the weather demands. He said over and over that he had been transformed by the decentralized collective spirit at Standing Rock, where no one was giving top-down orders, but everyone seemed to know or find out how they could most helpfully get to work. He said that the extreme weather conditions were unlike anything he had ever experienced and that they built character. Everyone, he said, realized that the struggle could not be maintained without collective effort. People take water bottles to bed with them at night, he said, so that they'll have water that isn't frozen to make coffee in the morning. In his evacuation order, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum accused the water protectors of creating a garbage and human waste problem that would pollute the Cannonball River when the melting snowpack flooded Oseti Sakawan. But Hanson said that the system devised to collect human waste was one of the most impressive collective efforts at Standing Rock. He said that it was odor-free, but that it required constant wood fires to keep the waste from freezing so that it could be removed. Water protectors have accused local garbage collectors of driving to Oseti Sakawan to dump garbage and blame it on them. Hanson Lee said that many of the water protectors who have been there through the winter are exhausted and that they continue to work long hours well into the night and they urgently need volunteer help now. He believes that the February 22nd evacuation order can be resisted with enough help. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
The Environmental Protection Agency's new administrator, Scott Pruitt, addressed his employees for the first time Tuesday afternoon. The audience included about 100 EPA employees. Environmentalists ardently opposed his nomination. The Sierra Club's executive director, Michael Brune, said John Moore is rolling over in his grave at the notion of someone as toxic to the environment as Scott Pruitt taking over the EPA. Pruitt asserted that we can be both pro-energy and jobs and pro-environment, leading the Center for Media and Democracy to say that Pruitt was already talking about putting the interests of the environment against the interests of industry. Pruitt did not mention that President Trump is expected to sign executive orders that would undermine two major EPA regulations later this year. The Clean Power Plan, one of Barack Obama's signature climate programs, and the Waters of the U.S. rule, which regulates pollution in smaller bodies of water.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 6 o'clock, it's Cutie Pock Talk. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight in Portland, rain showers will resume late and continue into tomorrow, with the wind dying down to 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow's high will be 45 with a low around 32 degrees. Hood River will be a bit colder tomorrow, with a low around 26 degrees. On this date, in 1965, minister and human rights activist Malcolm X, also known as El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, was assassinated while preparing to address the Organization of Afro-American Unity in Manhattan. Also on this date, in 1848, Karl Marx published his Communist Manifesto with the help of Friedrich Engels. And in 1828, the Cherokee Nation received their first printing press in Georgia with the intention of starting a newspaper using the freshly minted Cherokee alphabet. The quote of the day is from Malcolm X, who said, "You cannot separate peace from freedom, because no one can be at peace until he has his freedom."
The Department of Homeland Security has issued a pair of memos regarding the implementation of President Donald Trump's executive orders on immigration and border enforcement. Shannon Young reports.
The implementation memos signed by Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly and made public on Tuesday spell out how the agency intends to carry out the orders signed by President Trump in his first week in office. The specifics and the scope stunned even seasoned immigrant and refugee advocates who were already bracing themselves for a fight. The memos call for hiring thousands of new Immigration and Border Patrol agents, renewing efforts to have state and local police take on immigration enforcement duties, and expanding a procedure known as expedited removal.
That would be a breathtaking expansion of the ability to pick people up and remove them from the country without ever giving them a day in court.
Tom Jowitz is Vice President of Immigration at the Center for American Progress.
Expedited removal, for years now, the law and the memo sort of reviews this, has been that if you enter by land between the ports of entry and you're apprehended within 100 miles of the border and within 14 days of entry, you can be placed in expedited removal. The memo basically says the statutory maximum, the statute would allow them to extend that to any person who enters without inspection, who's apprehended anywhere in the country, who cannot affirmatively prove to the immigration officer that they have been in the country for 2 years.
Expedited removal is a euphemism for summary deportation, with no right to an attorney and no ability to appeal. Earlier this month, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a provision of the expedited removal process that prevents detainees from hiring legal counsel. The plaintiff argued that denying access to an attorney is a violation of the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause. The court rejected the arguments, noting that non-citizens do not enjoy full constitutional protections. The ruling was overshadowed by a higher-profile case before the court that same week, the challenge to Trump's travel ban on nationals from 7 Muslim-majority countries. In Tuesday's White House briefing, Press Secretary Sean Spicer made the case that the directives simply uphold the law.
Remember, everybody who is here illegally is subject to removal at any time. That is consistent with every country, not just ours. If you're in this country in an illegal manner, that obviously that there's a provision that could ensure that you be removed. But the priority that the president has laid forward and the priority that ICE is putting forward through DHS's guidance is to make sure that the people who have committed a crime or pose a threat to our public safety are the priority of their efforts, first and foremost.
But the DHS memos also signal an intent to go beyond enforcement of laws currently on the books.
The Interior Enforcement memo drastically distorts the terms smuggling and trafficking to make them somehow apply to fathers, mothers, grandparents, caregivers who put together what little money they have to save to help their children seek safety.
Jen Smyers, Associate Director for Immigration and Refugee Policy for the Church World Service, says that conflation can criminalize actions desperate relatives take to get children out of harm's way in countries like Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
This memo, which I should note, makes absolutely no mention of the dire circumstances of which these children flee, casts these actions of parents as, quote, conspiring to violate our immigration laws.
Asylum seekers applying through the traditional method of asking for protection at a port of entry are also facing an uphill battle. The memos indicate plans to reform the asylum system in a way advocates predict will make the already onerous process even more difficult. Lynn Tremonte, Deputy Director of America's Voice Education Fund, says the executive orders, the recent nationwide arrests by ICE, and now the DHS implementation memos have a combined effect that can be summed up in a phrase, attrition through enforcement.
This is a philosophy embraced by nativists that you crack down on immigration, make it really just impossible for people to live their lives here, hoping that they will pack up their own bags and leave, knowing that the government doesn't currently have the resources to deport 11 million people rapidly. And, you know, you are seeing this general anxiety and panic. We've seen it since the election, but it's become more acute among communities where children wonder if their parents are going to be there when they come home from school. And it's prevalent, it's oppressive, and it's just a reign of terror that people are living.
Immigration attorneys say many mixed status families are developing emergency plans, ranging from setting aside funds to fight deportations to establishing custody plans for U.S.-born children in the event they are suddenly separated from their parents. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The future of a federal program that gives temporary protection to young immigrants without legal status is uncertain. It's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. President Trump last week suggested he's reluctant to end the program, but new restrictions could be coming. Reporter Leslie Beristein Rojas has more.
Back in 2012, Jungwoo Kim was in his late 20s, just finishing college. He worked odd jobs as a valet and in restaurants. It was the only work he could get because he was in the country illegally. But that year, his life changed. The Obama administration rolled out the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. It grants temporary protection from deportation and work permits to young immigrants who came to the U.S. as minors. Kim came from South Korea when he was 15. He was nervous about applying for DACA, but he took the plunge.
I think there's two choices you can make: to get defeated by your fear, or you just overcome your fear.
With his work permit, he's held good jobs. He was an insurance agent until last year. Now he works for a community service nonprofit in Koreatown. Still, he worries that if the Trump administration scraps DACA,
that means I cannot drive, I cannot work, I cannot go back to school. Then what can I do?
President Trump initially said he'd do away with President Obama's executive actions, of which DACA is one. He's since taken a softer tone, but the arrest of a DACA recipient in Washington state has raised questions about what comes next for the 75,000 participants in the program. Karthik Ramakrishnan is a political scientist at UC Riverside.
There's a lot of uncertainty, not only as to whether they will renew the program, but what they'll do with people who currently have DACA.
John Miano is with the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors tighter immigration rules. He thinks it's likely Trump will phase out DACA.
I think he thinks it's unlawful, and I think the courts are going to find it's unlawful.
I already gave all my information to DHS.
Jungwoo Kim says he's bracing for the worst.
If they decide to get me, they get me. It's just a matter of time.
He's hoping it doesn't come to that. For the California Report, I'm Leslie Beristein Rojas.
The U.S. Supreme Court today rejected the request of a death row prisoner in Alabama to choose a firing squad over lethal injection. The court's denial is the latest chapter in a running debate over the morality of the death penalty and the methods used to carry it out. In 2015, the court ruled 5-4 that states could continue to use lethal injection that critics say can cause severe pain and suffering, even if a sedative makes it impossible to tell whether the condemned prisoner can feel its effects. In the case at hand, the plaintiff, Thomas Arthur, cited the risks in the use of the sedative midazolam and asked that a firing squad carry out the execution that had been scheduled 6 times since he killed his girlfriend's husband in 1982. Previous execution dates were blocked by legal challenges. The Supreme Court ruled that Arthur failed to prove the lethal injection would be painful. Moreover, the court said Alabama does not authorize the use of a firing squad.
Texas hunters suffering severe gunshot wounds told police that undocumented immigrants had attacked them, but a later investigation showed the hunters accidentally shot one another. A grand jury indicted Michael Bryant and Walker Doherty on charges of deadly conduct by discharging firearms in the direction of others. The indictment came after an investigation determined that Doherty sparked the incident when he tried to enter an RV occupied by 59-year-old Edwin Roberts. The incident took place in early January near a West Texas border community. Doherty and his fiancée told a local television station that they thought the shooters came from across the border. Initial accounts said the hunters were attacked on all sides by unknown assailants who wanted to steal the RV. But the U.S. Border Patrol dispatched dozens of agents and used thermal imaging technology to scan the premises and found no trace of any humans besides the hunting party. Investigators now believe that Bryant shot Doherty, who in turn shot Roberts.
Right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos has resigned from the alt-right website Breitbart News a day after his publisher axed a book deal and he lost a speaking job with a conservative conference. The resignation follows comments he made that appear to endorse sex between older men and younger boys. In a statement, Yiannopoulos said his decision to leave Breitbart was his own, and he left because he did not want to detract from the news from Breitbart. Some reports suggest that reporters there threatened to quit if Yiannopoulos was not fired. Yiannopoulos is seen as an internet is seen on an internet live stream appearance last year in which he said the age of consent was not this black and white thing and that relationships between younger boys and older men can be hugely positive. He said such relationships could be seen as coming of age relationships in which older men help younger boys discover who they are. The comments drew widespread condemnation. The American Conservative Union dropped its invitation for him to speak at its annual conference, and Simon & Schuster canceled its publication of his upcoming book, Dangerous.
It's 5:26 and 59 seconds, and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Remember way back in time, back in the old days of 2016, back then, Trump was on the political stump, promising that by gollies he would stop Wall Street bankers from scamming and robbing consumers and workers. Where did that guy go? To Wall Street. Once ensconced in the White House, Trump has openly betrayed us by helping the financial powers get more power to gouge. In fact, he has even put 6 Goldman Sachs executives in America's top economic policy positions. For example, one obscure Goldman Sachser named Steve Mnuchin is now honcho of the Treasury Department, overseeing America's economy. Aside from the fact that he played an ugly role in Wall Street's foreclosure frenzy, having forced some 10,000 homeowners out of their homes, Mnuchin also has an honesty problem. In submitting his statement of personal wealth to the U.S. Senate, oops, he failed to include $100 million in wealth that he had stashed in an offshore tax haven. Not trying to hide anything, just an oversight, he assured senators, claiming he was confused by the Senate's complicated financial reporting forms. Really? If this big-time banker can't keep track of $100 million worth of his own real estate assets, why trust him to handle the ultra-complex wealth of our nation? Is he lying or just incompetent? This is Jim Hightower saying, far from protecting us from Wall Street greed, Trump's Goldman Sachs Alumni Club is pushing so-called reforms to protect Wall Street from us. Their first move is to try killing the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the only federal agency whose only priority is to protect common consumers from credit card gouging, bank fraud, predatory payday lenders, and other corporate thievery. Trump's reforms are the biggest fraud of all. To battle them, contact Consumer Federation of America at consumerfed.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A 25-year-old British Muslim teacher was removed from his New York-bound flight in front of his students and says he was forced to get off the plane because of his religion. Jewel Mia, a math teacher who was born in Birmingham, England and grew up in Wales, told The Guardian newspaper that he was made to feel as if he were a criminal in front of his pupils and colleagues. He said he has no criminal record, has never been in trouble, and was in shock following the incident. Mia said he couldn't believe it was happening. "I felt powerless, as if I was being targeted and there was nothing I could do," he told the newspaper. Both he and his school are demanding an explanation from U.S. authorities. Mia said he got through an extensive security check, including a pat-down, and got on the plane only to be pulled off of it in a humiliating episode. He and other staff and the 39 students had stopped over in Iceland on their way to the U.S. Mia and his school are demanding an explanation from the U.S. government as to why he was not allowed to travel to New York with his students and colleagues, but so far, none has been forthcoming.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Thousands of people rallied on President's Day Monday in at least 25 U.S. cities for Not My President Trump resistance protests. From New York City to Los Angeles and many points in between, protesters reminded Trump that the vast majority of Americans did not vote for him.
Donald Trump is not my president because I would never have a president that would work to do away with Medicare. I would never have a president that would work to do away with Medicaid. I would never have a president that would work to corporatize and privatize Social Security. This is the start of a long march to D.C. and the midterms. This is not the end. This is the beginning. This is not the only rally. This is not the only group. This is not the only time we're going to gather together.
Trump resistance organizers are building a sustained resistance movement that they say will reach far beyond just street rallies. There are no official leaders. It is a people's movement. But the group Indivisible, launched by former Democratic political aides, aims to create a substantial foundation for a real sustained anti-Trump mass movement. They have created a resistance guide that's already being embraced nationwide.
Over 500,000 individuals have already downloaded the guide. Over 100,000 people have signed up in every congressional district in the country. And over 3,000 groups have registered in every state in the nation.
The widespread diverse movement started right after the inauguration with the Women's March. Resistance Recess is also targeting Congress with mass actions, in addition to the Not My President's Day actions. This is a people's movement that they say represents the will of the majority of American voters to resist Trump's agenda.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Media Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Monday, February 20th, 2017. Israeli troops destroy a UN-funded water pipeline. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israeli Navy attack fishermen. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli military bulldozers destroyed on Monday a drinking water pipeline that was funded by the United Nations International Children's Fund, UNICEF, in the central plains of the occupied West Bank. The pipeline provided clean drinking water for 47 families and extended for 8.5 kilometers. Israeli army jeeps and bulldozers invaded the area during early morning hours and destroyed the drinking water pipeline, providing water to Palestinian communities along the Al-Hadaida and Ras Al-Amur area. The pipeline's installation and equipment costs were little over 1 million euros provided by the UNICEF to enable access to clean drinking water. Soldiers confiscated large sections of the pipeline. It is worth mentioning that this destruction is the second of its kind in 1 month. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers have kidnapped overnight and at dawn Monday at least 22 Palestinians from various areas in the occupied West Bank and violently searched dozens of homes, the Palestinian Prisoner Society PPS has reported. Army home searches and abductions were reported in the West Bank districts of Nablus, Jenin, Qalqilya, Ramallah, Al-Bira, Jerusalem and Hebron. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli Navy attacked Palestinian fishing boats in 2 separate incidents on Monday, local sources reported. In the first attack, Israeli Navy forces opened live gunfire at Palestinian fishing boats while sailing off Beit Lahia coast, north of Gaza. Meanwhile, Navy ships targeted Palestinian fishing boats near the coast of Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Damage was reported, but no injuries in both attacks. And that's all for today from the IOMC News. This was the Monday, February 30th, 2017, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.immc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Mawi and me, Bassam Badmura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Letigre, Miriam Widman, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and KQED's California Report. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seiwei. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zell Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Tony. And these are the promos for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 22nd. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland invites your calls. At 9, Project Censored Radio reports on the group Brand New Congress, a campaign that intends to field a citizen-responsive candidate in every House district in 2018. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Recovery Zone looks at the benefits of soil carbon sequestration and regenerative agriculture. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
The industrial workers of the world, also known as the Wobblies, are notorious for doing what bosses view as causing trouble in workplaces. They call it worker organizing and are mounting grassroots campaigns across an array of industries, and their reach is global. The Seattle IWW recently made widespread press attention after one of its members was shot on Inauguration Day while protesting an appearance of Milo Yiannopoulos. KBOO's Kanan Schlesinger checked in with them over the weekend.
Okay, levels appear to be good. Okay, so can you start by just introducing yourself, obviously not by name if you don't prefer to?
Yeah, I am the communications secretary, the current communications secretary, that is, of the Seattle IWW branch.
Cool. And so can you talk a little bit about what the IWW is? You don't have, I mean, I know that's a humongous question, but and what is to you distinct about the Seattle branch?
Well, the IWW is an industrial internationalist union, radical labor union. The stated goal of the IWW is the abolition of the wage system. Pretty lofty goal, right? Something that we've been working very hard on since 1905 when the IWW was founded. In regards to the Seattle branch specifically, you know, the Seattle branch and radical labor organizing in general has a very long and storied history in Seattle and the greater Pacific Northwest. Over the past few years, the Seattle branch has was kind of undergoing a little bit of a drop in activity. But in, you know, given what happened with the election and, you know, the extreme level of threat that the working class is under with both people like Trump or Hillary Clinton or anybody else from either of the two parties in office, you know, it represents, both of those parties represent a major threat to the working class. And so I think largely in part because of that, the IWW has fortunately been seeing a large uptick in activity over the past year or two.
Cool. And so for people who aren't as familiar with the IWW and like the super rich and storied history that you mentioned, what was the IWW what would have brought the IWW out in a show of dissent or protest against the inauguration? And I guess, and was that intended to wind up on the UW campus?
So on the question of the Trump regime and what that represents to the IWW, we view that as a dire threat to the working class insofar as that you can see, for example, Republican legislators since Trump has taken office have introduced federal legislation to essentially make the entire country a right-to-work country, which is incredibly anti-union. It really gives all of the power to the bosses to do as they please with the workforce. And that represents one of the highest levels of threat to the working class that we're facing right now. In addition to that, you know, the National Labor Board now is under the control of the Trump administration, and that as well represents a high level of threat. The NLRB is generally what unions, including the IWW for the locals that have collective bargaining agreements, we rely to a certain extent on the NLRB to enforce certain laws against bosses. And with the Trump regime running that, it makes it a lot more difficult to ever rely on that. Not that the IWW did so much, because we know that anything that comes from the state is going to be suited towards the bosses. But regardless of that, it still is a big threat to us. Regarding Milo specifically, it was a very conscious decision on behalf of our branch to mobilize specifically to oppose Milo. And there's a couple of reasons for that. we feel that the type of speech and actions that Milo engages in are bigotry of the highest order. He attacks transgender folks. He attacks women. He attacks people of color. He attacks Muslims. And all of these are different populations that are very, very much so heavily represented in the working class, right? And one of the reasons that we think that it's so important to mobilize to try to deny a platform for these types of ideas to be expounded upon and propagated out to the general public is, well, for one reason, workers who are afraid of a very racially hostile environment, they're a lot more difficult to organize. I know one of the other IWW locals in the U.S. right now, as soon as Trump got elected, one of their organizing committees who they had been working on a campaign to get a workplace organized, one of the main people on the committee who was a gentleman from Mexico, had to drop out of organizing because he was too scared of the potential repercussions that he would face under the Trump regime. So on that fact alone, you know, organizing against hate speech is very much a part of the program of organizing the working class. And then if you want to take if you want to look through a historical lens of how fascism has impacted the working class, you can look at the Weimar Republic, you know, in the buildup to Nazi Germany. The Weimar Republic, the Nazis were able to utilize a lot of populist pro-worker policies to engage their working class into supporting a very, very terrible fascist model. And if we can organize against those level of like fascist ideas as they start to reemerge in our society, then that can help us prevent the working class from being subsumed into fascist ideology and mobilized along those lines. It's about providing an alternative, right? If there's nobody who is speaking from the general left up on behalf of the working class, then it's a lot easier for people like Trump, who have a lot of populist policies, such as his opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, if he's the only one who's speaking up